You're still grooving, still connecting, still loving, still turning up, still thriving. You still got it. But your immune system, it weakens as you age. That's where vaccines come in. They help train and strengthen your immune response to fight off respiratory illnesses like flu, pneumococcal pneumonia, RSV, or COVID-19. Ask your doctor or pharmacist which vaccines you need. Book in minutes at VaxAssist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
It's 5:05 and welcome into a Wednesday edition of the Carolina Journal News Hour on Charlotte's FM News Talk 107.9 WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Good morning to you. We've got an interesting article this morning over on our website, carolinajournal.com, with the headline, "Are Progressives Strategically Running in North Carolina Republican Primaries?" This is all because of a Durham area Republican candidate for the state legislature that has garnered national attention for her lengthy Democratic voting record and positions that some in the area say do not align with traditional GOP or Republican values. But experts say that there is little to be done about it given the state's commitment to holding open primaries. The individual whose name is LaShika Alston is the sole Republican running for the state's Senate District 22 seat. That is in Durham, went viral in December after social media posts highlighted what critics said were her dubious conservative credentials. Alston, who has been a registered voter in Durham since 2004, voted in three previous Democrat primary elections before switching to the Republican Party to vote in Durham's municipal elections in October of 2025. According to Andy Jackson, who is the director of the Civitas Center for Public Integrity, says it isn't uncommon to have candidates whose values misalign with those of the party during open primaries, and it's generally up to the voters to sort out whether that individual is suspected to not be the party in which they are registered, and if so, to vote them out of the primary. With Jackson telling the Carolina Journal, having unwelcome guests as candidates is the natural consequence of having a primary system as opposed to a nominating convention. It is exacerbated by North Carolina's open primaries, which are now mandated by law. Still, however, some say that the opposition has grown increasingly brazen in its efforts to meddle in the process itself rather than focus on robust debate over the issue. Matt Mercer, who is the director of communications for the North Carolina Republican Party, said, quote, "We are very aware of the far left playing games during candidate filing." And in an interview published last Friday at the Daily Caller News Foundation, Alston doubled down on her party identification, insisting that Republicans best align with her own values. Telling the Daily Caller, quote, I know that I have been seeing a lot of people with hesitation about the party that I chose to represent just because, you know, growing up, you pretty much do what your family does, what their beliefs are as far as your party. But like I said, I matured in my own revelation of what the Republican Party represents, and it looks like me." When pressed, Alston suggested that anything else might be a racist attempt to discredit her as a Republican, even though her voting record very clearly indicates she, in fact, is a Democrat, that she is a Democrat, telling the Daily Caller, "Are we going back to segregation times? Because I'm a Republican and I don't really understand the aims and the values of what the party represents. So I'm just going to be taken back as to what somebody looks like because that's what the Democrat Party used to do." Alston, who said her father was an Army veteran and fought in the Vietnam War, did elaborate on some of her stances in support of the Trump administration, including its tariffs policies, which actually is one of the things that has bucked traditional Republican support for free market trade. Alston also caused some controversy by wearing a full face covering in her photo that was published by the Durham County Board of Elections. She explained that in the interview as her Muslim-friendly attire as part of an effort to focus on substance over style. Telling the Daily Caller News Foundation, "I didn't want to go into it for the looks. I wanted this to be about who is most qualified." Durham Republicans, however, remain skeptical even after the interview with the Daily Caller, with Alston reportedly failing to identify any parts of the GOP platform in which she was aligned with during a November party reading, as the party meeting, I should say, with the Durham GOP chair and Christina Crosby telling the Carolina Journal, "We did our best to vet her as a candidate and others as they came forward. She was unable to articulate her positions as they relate to the Republican platform and didn't have much to say about anything as to how she believes." Crosby said Alston initially planned to challenge her cousin, State Representative Verena Alston, who was an incumbent Durham, Democrat in Durham, but instead filed for the state Senate race. Because of the December the 19th filing deadline for primaries has well lapsed at this point, she will be the only Republican candidate on the ballot in North Carolina's Senate district for the 22nd district. However, Durham Republicans hope to file a petition to field an alternative for the November election, with the Durham County Republican Party chairwoman saying, "What we do plan to do is collect 250 signatures to request a write-in option on the November ballot, and we'll find somebody that will run and we can put down." Regardless, it may be a moot point due to the fact of how deep blue this district is in Durham, where Democrats enjoy a 31-point electoral advantage, meaning the idea that a Republican could win in that race almost impossible. Even the Durham County GOP chairwoman agrees with that, telling the Carolina Journal they will likely both lose to the Democrat challenger, which is whoever passes the primary on the Democrat side of the aisle. While Alston's run may prove to be a little more than a political spectacle, several competitive races do feature GOP candidates whose voting records may warrant additional and extra scrutiny, with Matt Mercer saying that the North Carolina Republican Party is not at liberty to discuss specific candidates during the primary, but has flagged concerns over members of the NC Educators on the ballot, a group led by registered Democrats. The self-declared grassroots campaign, founded by a retired educator by the name of Patricia Saylor, is encouraging teachers to run as a way to reinforce the state's and reform the state's education funding. Its website lists six active candidates seeking House seats in the North Carolina General Assembly, although it is important to note that the candidate from Durham that we're talking about is not one of them. With Saylor saying at a rally in September, "Because for so many seats, the only path to Raleigh is through a Republican primary, that is where we need to go," end quote. Andy Jackson from the John Locke Foundation said other high-profile examples of alleged primary meddling, including the Fire Madison campaign, which was set to oust U.S. Representative Madison Cawthorn, who was a staunch ally of President Donald Trump in the 2024 race. Political attacks on Cawthorn ultimately has likely succeeded in weakening his appeal, even though Republican voters broke for a more traditional establishment Republican candidate. That was Republican Chuck Edwards over the progressive alternative in the race. According to Andy Jackson, the solution is simple. The Republican Party should, quote, do a better job of candidate recruitment. He conceded that the situation was different in deep blue districts like the one that we're talking about in Durham this morning, where elections may be statistically improbable, if not impossible. Nonetheless, he said it was unlikely to help the GOP, saying, quote, "I don't see much of an upside for Republicans, although a warm body is better than nothing." Meanwhile, for opponents who use the primary to push so-called fake Republicans into competitive races, the upside remains clear, with Andy Jackson saying while they will not win, it could make those incumbents use resources that they otherwise would have used in preparation for the general election. The reaction does continue this morning about this candidate running in a Durham Senate district, Senate District 22. You can read some additional quotes from Dr. Andy Jackson and check out parts of the interview with the Daily Caller News Foundation with that individual. Those details this morning are over on our website, carolinajournal.com. Again, that story's headline, "Are Progressives Strategically Running in NC GOP Primaries?" Additional coverage at carolinajournal.com.
You're still grooving, still connecting, still loving, still turning up, still thriving. You still got it, but your immune system, it weakens as you age. That's where vaccines come in. They help train and strengthen your immune response to fight off respiratory illnesses like flu, pneumococcal pneumonia, RSV, or COVID-19. Ask your doctor or pharmacist which vaccines you need. Book in minutes at vaxassist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
It's 520. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour, Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 WBT. Don't forget that you can take the show with you on demand on your own time by checking out the Carolina Journal News Hour in your favorite podcast app. You can also watch the show live and on demand on our Carolina Journal YouTube channel. Every month here in North Carolina, the Council of State meets. That includes individuals like the governor, the secretary of state, the auditor, labor commissioner, individuals that you may have seen on a statewide ballot back in 2024. That is what makes up the North Carolina Council of State. As we kick off the year here in 2026, they did hold a meeting this week, and a lot of the conversation still surrounds the lack of a full budget from the North Carolina General Assembly. That's something that we've been covering very closely here on the Carolina Journal News Hour and over on our website, carolinajournal.com, to walk us through the latest out of the Council of State as it relates to the budget. Teresa Opeka, carolinajournal.com, joins us on the News Hour. Teresa, throughout the summer of last year, we were kind of waiting to see would the General Assembly of the House and the Senate, Republican leadership there, get together on a full budget. That did not happen. Here we are, first couple of weeks of 2026. No idea exactly what that's going to look like. And now the Council of State's chiming in. What did you learn from their meeting this week?
Yeah, good morning, Nick. Thanks for having me. So yeah, the long overdue budget, in fact, the only state in the nation that did not pass a budget last year, as we've been reminded by Governor Stein and others, really is impacting quite a few state agencies. We did hear from Secretary of State Elaine Marshall at the Council of State meeting on Tuesday, who said, you know, her agency's workload has more than doubled since 2017, but her staffing level stayed about the same. And she has called on legislators since 2023 to give more funding for her department, who she says is either the second lowest or the last worst funded, as you will, I mean, not her words, but the lowest funded agency of all agencies in the state for all the work that they're doing. You know, they get all these entrepreneurs, new business owners coming in, filings for new businesses, all this work. As she said, it's more than doubled since 2017. And they're facing a real crisis. She said it's no longer a challenge. It's a risk at this point. And the issue is not a partisan issue. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It is strictly an issue that basically probably burnout for her employees. And we did hear from others as well. But yeah, so they are calling renewed calls to pass a budget in the General Assembly.
Teresa, we do have a statute here in North Carolina, or I should say a legislation law that's on the books that in which the state does not shut down. We saw federal government shut down last year. The state of North Carolina doesn't have that. Maybe a little bit of a blessing and a curse, because if there is no budget, which is, you noted, North Carolina is the only one in the nation to have not passed one in 2025, the government continues to operate, but it's at previous year levels. So as offices expand, as you noted with the Secretary of State, CNBC's ranked North Carolina, what, the number one state for business 3 out of the last 5 years. People are opening businesses, a lot more work coming out of the Secretary of State and other agencies here across the state of North Carolina. So they're funded, but Teresa, that funding level is from years past, meaning no growth, no expansion, no bonuses, no additional salaries unless we get a new budget out of Raleigh.
Right, right. So yeah, the General Assembly, they've been operating without a full biennial budget, new budget, since July 1st. As you say, they have a budget to fall back on. It's a good thing in a way, maybe for giving a little leeway. But when you're talking about being months overdue, it's not, you know, not such a great thing. Other states, like I think Pennsylvania was the last state before North Carolina to pass its budget. They don't have a biennial. So they run out of money. They run out of money, much like other states too. So North Carolina is unique in that fact they had the full biennial budget, but it is creating a lot of headaches for all these different agencies. You also had Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey talk about that as well, and Governor Stein, who has been pushing for, you know, more teacher pay, more state workers need better pay rates, all of that, because they are, you know, they're having the same pay as they had before. There's been no pay raises because, you know, a new budget hasn't been passed.
And Teresa, what makes this even a more interesting discussion, and we've talked about this a lot, is this is a Republican versus Republican dispute. Republicans hold the majority in the North Carolina House. They have that same majority in the North Carolina Senate, and appears to be at very high levels of both of those chambers. There is some disagreement over how things are set to be handled. It appears that a lot of it has to deal with some triggers as it relates to continued reductions in both personal and corporate tax rates. Do we have any idea now here in 2026, lawmakers will be making their way back to Raleigh over the next couple of weeks, that they will take on this some of these calls from people like Elaine Marshall and Governor Josh Stein, or can they continue to coast on this previous year budget, seemingly all the way up until the next General Assembly is sworn in, which would happen sometime in early 2027?
Yeah, that is a very good question. That remains to be seen if they're going to keep coasting or they will do something about this. You know, you had Governor Stein, you know, and the Human Health, DHHS, Health and Human Services, make a big push for, you know, more Medicaid rebase funding. You know, they kept pushing, saying, we're going to run out of money. But, you know, the legislature said, no, you've got enough money till April. Well, now it's January. So are they going to take a look at that before April? Are they going to go in there with a budget, or are they going to do what they've been doing, little mini budgets, if you will, where they pass a few measures and keep chugging along, but it's not a full budget. It's not a budget where you're going to see salaries being increased or maybe Medicaid rebase funding. But that is definitely a good question. You know, remains to be seen. We've heard no rumblings whatsoever. We'll just have to, you know, tune in and find out when they have their next meeting.
And you talk about those mini budgets. That is what we have seen. And some agencies have seen some increases. We saw back with the DAVE Act and some of the changes, and over at the state auditor's office, there has been some increased funding there as some of the roles and responsibilities shift, the Board of Elections, now some of those appointment authorities, this new DAVE Act, which gives some higher authority to the auditor's office. So it seems like some agencies are being taken care of, but we're hearing from others that maybe they feel like that maybe the love is not being spread around, Teresa, to every member of the Council of State.
Yeah, it sure sounds that way. They need to, you know, share the love a little further in some of these other agencies, that's for sure.
You've got additional quotes from this Council of State meeting on Tuesday. Where can folks go and get those details this morning?
Sure. They can head on over to carolinajournal.com.
We appreciate the update this morning. Teresa Opeka joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour.
You're still grooving, still connecting, still loving, still turning up, still thriving. You still got it, but your immune system, it weakens as you age. That's where vaccines come in. They help train and strengthen your immune response to fight off respiratory illnesses like flu, pneumococcal pneumonia, RSV, or COVID-19. Ask your doctor or pharmacist which vaccines you need. Book in minutes at vaxassist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
It's 5:35. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour. Charlotte's FM News Talk, 107.9 FM, WBT. I'm Nick Craig. Good Wednesday morning to you. Undoubtedly, the largest story that we covered in North Carolina throughout 2025 was the brutal, the horrific murder of Irina Zarutska on the Charlotte Light Rail back in late August of 2025. That story gained not only national but international attention, prompting reaction from as high as the President of the United States to foreign news services, and now it has transitioned into a legal challenge that is taking place at both the state and federal level. There have been some questions about why there's not been any additional footage released from the footage we saw in early September, and that's because it is part of an ongoing legal battle going through the court system. To walk us through some of those details this morning, Mitch Kokai with the John Locke Foundation joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour. Mitch, there is some level of video. The murder happened in late August, but it wasn't until a couple of weeks after that that surveillance footage from CATS, the Charlotte Area Transportation System, started making its way around the internet that this story exploded and I would argue became our largest story in 2025. What's the latest that you're following in the courts over additional footage from that brutal night in late August?
Well, you're exactly right, Nick, that the footage that we saw that came from CATS itself was what turned this story into from a local crime story that would have had some coverage into this national and international story that we've seen. But the footage that we've seen so far came from the light rail system itself. We have not seen body cam footage from officers who were involved in this case, nor have we heard from what I could tell, the 911 calls that are related to this that are in the possession of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Now, in October, a couple of months after Arena Zarutska's killing, WSOC Television went to the court and said, hey, we'd like to get access to this footage. Other media outlets, I'm sure, would be interested also as well. But at this point, we know of one television station that had actually put in a formal request. We didn't really hear much about it until much later. And then just this week, a state court judge dealing with the murder charge in this case held a hearing to deal with the release of body cam footage and basically took a couple of steps. In the first case, Arena Zarutska's family had said that they didn't want the media to have access to this footage, but they wanted to be able to get access to the recordings. And the judge said, yes, the family can have access, but no release to any third party. So the family itself could look, but that would be it. But then in a second hearing, the family dropped their request that the media not have access to it as long as the family members could also be able to give this video footage to a third party. And the judge at the state level said that WSOC could have access to the footage. What was going to happen was that as had been put forward as an option by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, the TV station could look at the footage and then make a request for what they wanted to have released. And then the police department could make that happen. Well, within the same day that the state court made up its decision that WSOC could have access to this material, DeCarlos Brown, who is the defendant in this case, the one who appears to be on the CATS video footage stabbing Arena Zarutska, his attorneys went to a federal court, which is also involved in this case, and has a federal charge on which he's been indicted that could ultimately lead to the death penalty. Yeah. In this case, the lawyers went to federal court and said, hey, we have an emergency motion for you to block CMPD from releasing this information because it could prejudice our client's case. And within the same day, so we've had the state court hearing, then an emergency motion to the federal court, and then on that same day, a federal magistrate judge's ruling, Judge David Kiesler, came out and said, yes, I'm going to have a preliminary order here that says that there should be no release of any of this footage to the television station. And I could change my mind based on other things that come forward. If someone puts forward a compelling argument about why this should happen, I could change my mind. But for now, there's going to be no release of this footage based on the request that was put in by DeCarlos Brown's lawyers, who say that this case has had such national attention that any release of this footage could prejudice his case. He is, as we said, he's facing murder charge on the state level, but also facing a federal charge because this took place on a light rail line that gets federal funding, and that charge on the federal level could make him eligible for the death penalty. So for now, unless we see anything further, that this footage will remain in the custody of Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department and will not be released to anyone else, including any media outlets.
You know, Mitch, this is interesting. We had typically, or I shouldn't say typically, we have seen this from time to time, not even here in North Carolina, but across the country with these very high profile cases. Most of the time, it does unfortunately happen to be a murder in which the case rises to this level of national or international prominence, as we saw with the killing of Irina Zarutska in Charlotte back in the late summer of 2025. So we've got kind of the both angles here. Obviously, the public is interested in this, Mitch. It was a huge story throughout the state. Remains to be one right now. They want to see, obviously, as much information. But on the flip side, you do have to protect the legal proceedings that are going to take place. You need to have a jury pool that isn't potentially tainted. And that's, of course, going to be hard with the insane amount of coverage that this got. Mitch, you follow a lot of legal challenges here and a lot of cases in North Carolina. Is this something that is pretty bog standard with a case that is this high profile?
It's going to be very interesting to see what ultimately happens with this footage, because remember, we have seen footage of the actual stabbing that didn't come from the law enforcement footage, and it's not entirely clear what we're going to see if we end up seeing anything from the law enforcement footage, because that would be from the arrest, from the efforts to get DeCarlos Brown and get him into custody. So it remains to be seen how that could affect the court case. But certainly at this point, his attorneys don't want to see any of this released because they think that there's at least the chance that it could cause prejudice for his case. We also have the factor in North Carolina that you have to take into effect that these records are not considered quite public records. It's not the case of this is a public record, you release it, and the only reason you wouldn't release it is if there's a compelling reason to do so. These are documents or records that are kept by the law enforcement agency, and there has to be a reason put forward why they should be released. And so family members, people who are on the footage, people who are defendants who would like to use this material to help them in their defense, they generally can get access to this material. But in terms of anyone else from the public, including members of the media, getting access to these types of records, it really is, in many cases, up to the discretion of the judge and whether the judge thinks this is going to be something that will be prejudicial, whether the public's right to see this is outweighs that, whether there's not likely to be much prejudice, and if so, does the public's access to this material outweigh that? It really is a part of North Carolina's legal history that's still in many ways being written, which I guess shouldn't surprise us too much, because having the body cam footage is still something that's not too deep into our past. I mean, we've only been dealing with this for a matter of years rather than decades. And sure, so a lot of this is still being written.
Mitch, let me end on this. And you brought up the public record side of this. If you wanted to request the public records of a county commissioner and city council, typically that stuff is turned over in a relatively expeditious manner. As you're mentioning now, maybe things are a little bit different. Is that because we're dealing with a law enforcement agency and ongoing pending legal challenges and trials? Is that where the distinction draws, as CMPD is in fact a taxpayer-funded public entity that exists here in North Carolina?
That's part of it. It's also the difference between these law enforcement recordings and a typical public record. If you went to CMPD and said, I'd like to get a record of your budget or some other document that is typically considered a public record, I think they would have to turn them over unless there was some sort of ongoing legal case that they could make an argument that they'd have to hold it back. But these law enforcement recordings have always been treated a little bit differently, that they're not quite public records in the sense of other records. And because I think of their tie-in to the legal proceedings and the fact that you don't want to release something that's going to end up tainting a case, either for a defendant or for the plaintiff, you would, or the state, in this case, in a criminal case, you would want to make sure that that these are released only in a way that's not going to hurt the criminal justice system. And that's one reason why it's a little bit different than going to a county commissioner or city council and saying, give me this record.
We appreciate the information and the update this morning. You can read additional coverage by visiting our website, carolinajournal.com. Mitch Kokai from the John Locke Foundation joins us on the Carolina Journal News Hour.
You're still grooving, still connecting, still loving, still turning up, still thriving. You still got it, but your immune system, it weakens as you age. That's where vaccines come in. They help train and strengthen your immune response to fight off respiratory illnesses like flu, pneumococcal pneumonia, RSV, or COVID-19. Ask your doctor or pharmacist which vaccines you need. Book in minutes at VaxAssist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer.
Good morning again. It's 5:50. Welcome back to the Carolina Journal News Hour on Charlotte's FM News Talk 107.9 WBT. We are tracking some other news this morning over on our website, carolinajournal.com. This is revolving around a national story that could have some implications here in North Carolina, as despite reports that the Trump administration was set to freeze child care funding to all 50 states, this is after alleged widespread daycare fraud in the state of Minnesota. To this point, North Carolina has not received any official notice of such action. North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson and the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services responded to those reports in a press release this week issued by Jackson's office. An official from the United States Department of Health and Human Services, so we've got our state DHHS, and then at the national level, the HHS agency, told ABC News on December the 31st that it would pause the funding aid, stating that the funds will be released, quote, only when states prove they are being spent legitimately. The accusations stem from online videos showing the alleged fraud in child care centers within the Somali communities within the state of Minnesota. Other reports state that investigators found fraud schemes masquerading as daycare centers, medical providers, food assistance programs, as well as other alleged state programs purportedly taking billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars worth of money in federal funding. State officials, including Democratic Governor Tim Walz, have denied the accusations. However, the two-term governor and vice presidential candidate with Kamala Harris in the 2024 presidential election announced on Monday that he would not be seeking re-election. And while he admitted it was not because of the fraud scheme, it's hard to look at another major story that could cause him to drop out of this race, with Minnesota Republican lawmakers saying that his decision does not leave him off the hook for the scandal. Back here in North Carolina, Attorney General Jeff Jackson said in the press release, if fraud is discovered here, we will pursue it aggressively and make sure those responsible face consequences. That's what our fraud prosecutors do every day. When people steal taxpayer monies, they're stealing it from kids and families. We have zero tolerance for it, and we'll use every tool we have to stop it. End quote there from the North Carolina Attorney General. The Child Care and Development Fund, known as the CCDF, is the federal grant program which is administered by the Federal Department of Human Services, helps low-income families pay for child care. States use the funds to reimburse child care providers, subsidize care costs for eligible families, and ensure basic safety and quality standards are met. Jackson also noted that North Carolina issues subsidy payments to child care providers after attendance is submitted, as well as an HHS announcement on Monday that it would be rescinding a series of Biden-era child care rules that require states to pay providers before verifying any attendance does not pertain to the process and how that plays out here in North Carolina. The Child Care Development Fund requires states to have monitoring and reporting processes that are aligned with federal funding compliance inspections, including subsidy compliance training for child care providers, random monitoring visits, reviewing attendance and/or arrival or departure records or logs, targeted technical assistance, investigations, full reported cases of fraud, and corrective action plans to support providers with compliance. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services Division of Child Development and Early Education also works closely with the Office of the Internal Auditor within the NCDHHS to establish and enforce additional measures to identify and find occurrences of fraud where they may exist. DHHS said in a press release, "Our priority is making sure North Carolina children and families have access to care and resources that they need to thrive. We are committed to strong oversight so child care dollars are used appropriately and reach the families that they are intended to support. We are looking closely with our federal partners to protect funding and to minimize any disruptions for children, families, and providers." The North Carolina Department of Justice included in a press release that any complaints or concerns about potential fraud can be filed by calling a state number to report. That is 800-859-0829, or those complaints can also emailed or sent directly to the North Carolina Department of Justice. We've got links on this story, which includes some of the information here from Attorney General Jeff Jackson, and that contact information, those details over on our website this morning. CarolinaJournal.com, the story's headline, NC officials say no notice of federal child care funding freeze. We'll continue to track this story as it continues to unfold, as that fraud story in Minnesota does remain and does continue to get major headlines across the nation. As you may have seen earlier this week, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who announced back in September of 2025 that he would be seeking a third term as the governor of the state of Minnesota, announced in a press conference on Monday that he would in fact not be moving forward with running for a third term. He claimed that he was going to spend his time trying to clean up the fraud situation that seemingly exists within his state, and he would not be taking time away from that very important effort to campaign, even though he just ran for vice president back just a couple of years ago. This story continues to have major impacts not only across the state of Minnesota, but across pretty much every other state as well. We'll continue to follow the impact here across the state of North Carolina over on our website, CarolinaJournal.com. That's going to do it for a Wednesday edition of the Carolina Journal News Hour. WBT News is next, followed by Good Morning BT. We're back with you tomorrow morning, 5 to 6, right here on Charlotte's FM News Talk 107.9 WBT.
You're still grooving, still connecting, still loving, still turning up, still thriving. You still got it, but your immune system, it weakens as you age. That's where vaccines come in. They help train and strengthen your immune response to fight off respiratory illnesses like flu, pneumococcal pneumonia, RSV, or COVID-19. Ask your doctor or pharmacist which vaccines you need. Book in minutes at vaxassist.com. Sponsored by Pfizer. Let's go.